content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine's edition dated May 25, 2026. The front cover, as usual, is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital letters in red, superimposed over a pale blue background. The World Cup is also a caption on the cover in white. There's a person whose photograph is prominent on the cover, Christian Pulisic, P-U-L-I-S-I-C, Captain America, steps onto sport's biggest stage. This is a young man, Caucasian, with lots of tattoos on his left arm. He has dark hair, dark eyes, dark facial hair. He's wearing a red and white striped shirt or jersey, I guess you'd call it, with USA and number 10 on the front. It appears that he's wearing white pants. I don't know if they're long or short because the photo ends above the knees. Beginning with the brief, Leaving Europe, by Rebecca Schneid. U.S. troops face a drawdown as Trump's Iran war spills into the future of NATO. An announcement by the Trump administration that the U.S. would withdraw 5,000 troops from Germany has shaken America's European allies. But it may just be the beginning of a much wider withdrawal from the continent. The Pentagon blandly stated May 1 that the decision came after a thorough review of the department's force posture in Europe and is in recognition of theater requirements and conditions on the ground. But President Donald Trump made clear politics played a major role in the decision and that more troop withdrawals could follow, a move that would represent a dramatic scale back of the U.S. commitment to European security and NATO deterrence. We're going to cut way down, Trump said in Palm Beach, Florida, and we're cutting a lot further than 5,000. Trump's move came amid long simmering tensions between the U.S. and its longtime European allies, which have been made worse by disagreements over the war in Iran. Trump has expressed anger at European allies, most of them fellow NATO members, after they refused to provide support to the U.S. and Israel's war. When NATO countries declined to send warships to help open the Strait of Hormuz, he called them useless and cowards, and has since been seemingly trying to punish his European allies. An internal Pentagon email, first reported by Reuters, April 24, laid out a series of ways the U.S. could respond to difficult allies, such as reviewing diplomatic support for European countries' imperial possessions, like the U.K.'s claim to the Falkland Islands, or floating the idea of suspending Spain from NATO. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz earned Trump's ire for criticizing the Iran war, saying the U.S. is being humiliated by the conflict. The Iranians are obviously very skilled at negotiating, or rather, very skillful at not negotiating, letting the Americans travel to Islamabad and then leave again without any result, Merz said, April 27. Germany's defense minister, Boris Pistorius, said Trump's withdrawal was anticipated and the presence of American troops in Europe, particularly in Germany, lies in our interest and in the interest of the U.S. Even with the drawdown, Germany will still host more than 30,000 U.S. troops. But there were signs of Republican opposition to Trump's move. The Republican chairman of the Senate and House Armed Services Committees released a statement May 2 saying they were very concerned about the troop withdrawal. Germany has stepped up in response to President Trump's call for greater burden sharing, significantly increasing defense spending and providing seamless access, basing, and overflight for U.S. forces in support of Operation Epic Fury, said Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi and Representative Mike Rogers of Alabama in a joint statement. In withdrawing troops, these lawmakers argue, the U.S. could send the wrong signal to Vladimir Putin and Russia as the country continues its invasion of Ukraine. Trump's European withdrawal goes far beyond Germany. The president threatened he would probably pull back troops from Spain and Italy, too, as his relationship with the nation's leaders has deteriorated, also over the Iran war. Why shouldn't I? Italy has not been of any help to us, and Spain's been horrible, absolutely horrible, he told reporters at the White House April 30, arguing the U.S. helped Europe defend Ukraine from Russia's invasion, but Europe declined to enter the attack on Iran. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez clashed with Trump after calling U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran illegal and refusing U.S. access to Spain's joint military bases for operations related to the war. Italy also denied a U.S. military aircraft use of the Sigonella Air Base in Sicily, citing the failure to obtain prior authorization before departing. Unlike Spain, Italy has a conservative leader, Giorgia Meloni, who was once a staunch ally of Trump in Europe. But following Meloni's opposition to the Iran war and her criticism of Trump's attacks on Pope Leo XIV, Trump called her unacceptable. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has told NATO allies across Europe to expect weapons delays as the U.S. works to replenish its own stockpiles depleted by the Iran war. The U.K., Poland, Lithuania, and Estonia are among the countries expected to face delays, the Financial Times reported May 1. These delays have heightened concerns about Ukraine's shortages of U.S.-made missile systems that it uses to defend against Russian attacks. European leaders meeting in Yerevan, Armenia, May 4, expressed surprise about the timing of Trump's move, but not about the trajectory of U.S. support. I think it shows we have to really strengthen the European pillar in NATO, said Kaja Kallas, European Union's foreign policy chief. When asked if she believed Trump's Germany troop withdrawal was an attempt to punish Merz for his criticism of the Iran war, Kallas replied, I don't see into the head of President Trump, so he has to explain it himself. Here's an almost half-page photo in color with a caption. I'll try to describe the scene first. It's panoramic. In the back, there's a pale blue sky with white clouds. In the middle ground, there is a pale gray sedimentary structure, like the side of a mountain, except it's very long and low. In the foreground, there's greenery, lots of greenery, trees, bushes, grass. And in the immediate foreground, there's a gentleman standing in a gray suit with a pale blue or off-white shirt, a dark blue striped tie. He has white hair. It's shining in the sun. He's wearing dark glasses. He's smiling at the camera. And I will read the caption. It is a royal visit. King Charles III poses at the Dickey Ridge Trail Visitor Center in Shenandoah National Park in Virginia, April 30. King Charles and Queen Camilla made a state visit at the end of April to mark the 250th anniversary of America's independence. The royals also traveled to New York City and Washington, D.C., where the king addressed a joint session of Congress. The Bulletin by Miranda J.R. Etnam. Swiss voters to decide whether to cap population. An unusual proposal by the right-wing Swiss People's Party to limit Switzerland's population appears to be gaining ground despite concerns it could endanger the economy and relations with the European Union. Under the proposal, if the country's population exceeds 9.5 million before 2050, the government would have to take measures to curb immigration, including tightening rules for asylum and permanent residence. Crossing that threshold would also force the government to renegotiate international agreements that drive population growth, according to the proposal. If the population hits 10 million, Switzerland would likely have to abandon a free movement agreement with the EU that's been in place for more than 20 years. The country is not an EU member. Switzerland's experienced rapid population growth, largely driven by immigration, with the population increasing by 1.9 million since 2000, according to think tank Avenir Suisse. The population exceeded 9 million last year, with foreign nationals accounting for around 27% per government data. The Swiss People's Party argues uncontrolled immigration is placing overwhelming pressure on Switzerland's public infrastructure and driving up housing costs. Many lawmakers have opposed the proposal, and the government rejected it in March. But more than 114,000 people signed on to the initiative, reaching the threshold for a referendum, which will be held June 14. Economie Suisse, Switzerland's largest business federation, has objected to the proposal, warning that limiting immigration could lead to labor shortages in industries that depend on foreign labor, like healthcare and services. But a survey of 16,176 respondents in late April showed 52% were in favor of the proposal, while 46% were against it. The remaining 2% were undecided. The results suggest support for the proposal has grown since early March, when a poll showed 45% of respondents in favor and 47% against. Turning the page to the brief news, good question. Is CDC messaging affecting people's trust in vaccines? By Jeffrey Kluger, vaccines have long been considered by experts to be among the most studied medical interventions, and on the whole, Americans are still broadly supportive of them. But during President Donald Trump's second term, the agency that makes recommendations about vaccines, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, has, without new scientific evidence, cast fresh doubt on their safety and resurfaced the disproven link between vaccines and autism. Before November 19, 2025, the CDC's website was unequivocal on the topic. Studies have shown there is no link between receiving vaccines and developing autism spectrum disorder, it read. That guidance has since been essentially reversed. It now says, the claim vaccines do not cause autism is not an evidence-based claim because studies have not ruled out the possibility that infant vaccines cause autism. studies supporting a link have been ignored by health authorities. The assertion is false, reflecting the long-standing vaccine-skeptical views of Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., Secretary of Health and Human Services, HHS, and new research published in the journal Science suggests that it's affecting what Americans believe. What concerns me is not only the immediate effect on vaccine attitudes, but also the broader downstream effects, reduced trust in the CDC, and greater endorsement of science denial practices may shape how people will engage or not engage with information about vaccines more generally, says Robert Boehm, professor of psychology at the University of Vienna, who led the new study. To conduct their work, Bam and his colleagues asked nearly 3,000 U.S. adults a range of questions about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. Before answering the questions, people read either the CDC's former position on vaccines and autism, the CDC's new stance, or nothing at all. Reading the statements seemed to influence how people felt about vaccines. The group that read the CDC's old position, for example, was less likely to believe vaccines might cause adverse effects. The group that read the new, more skeptical position was a bit likelier to believe it. When people were asked if they would get a recommended vaccine, those who read the new position were less enthusiastic than those who read the old one. Trust in the CDC itself was boosted by the old vaccine statement and lowered by the new one. The researchers also looked at some of the tropes and arguments the anti-vaccine movement often deploys, such as setting impossible standards of scientific proof and cherry-picking data. Conspiracy theories and logical fallacies were tested, too. In all of these cases, people who read the new CDC statement were more likely to take the bait, while people who read the old one were less likely to believe them. It is always difficult to attribute changes in vaccination rates to one single factor, Bam said. But in my view, this shift in CDC communication could indeed contribute to declining vaccine confidence and ultimately lower vaccination rates. Bam and his team are not the only ones looking at how people form opinions about vaccines. In a new study published in the journal Vaccine, researchers surveyed nearly 3,000 U.S. adults to determine where they get their daily news and whether that seemed to influence their views on vaccines. People who consumed news from the New Right media, which often attracts vaccine-skeptical viewpoints, were more than twice as likely to be vaccine-hesitant as people who got their information either from more mainstream or left-wing outlets. As easily as vaccine guidance from the top has shifted, it could shift back under new leadership. Research has shown communicating scientific consensus can strengthen trust in science, Bam says. So if that communication changes, it can also change how people think about vaccines. If not, he warns, the country risks more outbreaks of preventable diseases. We should not imagine epidemics as something that only happens after vaccination rates collapse dramatically, Bam says. For highly contagious diseases such as measles, even relatively small declines in vaccine confidence and uptake can create pockets of vulnerability. Here is the milestones page. There are two longer articles and four short ones. I'll start with those. Broken, the 2-hour mark for the men's marathon, by Sebastian Sawe. During a race in London, April 26, the Kenyan completed it in 1 hour, 59 minutes, 30 seconds, a new world record. Announced by the United Arab Emirates, April 28, it will exit the OPEC cartel. Experts said the country's departure from the group could lead to even more volatile oil prices. Shuttered. Spirit Airlines, the low-cost carrier that had been in business for more than 30 years, May 2. The airline had faced financial hardship in recent years, but said rising fuel costs were the final straw. Fled. More than 5,400 people after clouds of ash burst from Mayon volcano in the northeastern Philippines, May 2 to 3. The volcano did not explosively erupt, but its ash affected more than 120 villages. First long article, ruled, voting rights map overturned, by Philip Wang. In a landmark ruling, April 29, the Supreme Court moved to undermine a major provision of the Voting Rights Act, further eroding a law long hailed as a cornerstone of the civil rights movement. At issue was a map the Louisiana legislature passed in 2022 that a group of black voters argued violated the act by packing the state's black population into one congressional district. In response, a court ordered the state to draw a new map. A group of non-African American voters then argued in a new lawsuit that the replacement map violated the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause by sorting voters based on race. The justices agreed, 6-3, describing the map as an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. The High Court has been chipping away at the Voting Rights Act's power for years. Now, as several Republican-led states launched plans to quickly redraw their maps before this year's midterm elections, the ruling is expected to accelerate a volatile new era of partisan redistricting across the country. And finally, the longer article in Milestones, died Ted Turner, Nonstop News Visionary, by Callum Sutherland. There's a photo here of Turner, I'd say, from 1982, it says right there. Remade the media landscape. He's in a TV studio leaning on a TV set whose monitor has a photograph of himself. Ted Turner was a tall man in this photo from 1982, gray-haired, with a graying mustache. He's dressed in a dark blue suit, it looks like, probably a gray and white striped shirt and a dark gray tie. Not quite smiling, but close. On the background, it's dark because he's in a darkened room with some lighting. CNN cable news is shown on the wall. When Ted Turner founded Cable News Network, CNN, in 1980, he forever transformed media by establishing a 24-hour rolling broadcast of news. In the years that followed, even as Turner went on to found TNT, TCM, and the Cartoon Network, the constant presence of up-to-the-minute news and later talk about it became a defining feature of modern life. The entrepreneur who revealed in 2018 that he had been diagnosed with Lewy body dementia, a progressive brain disorder that affects memory and other cognitive functions, died May 6 at 87. Following the media mogul's death, CNN chief international anchor Christiane Amanpour said, "Working for Ted and his vision has been the proudest achievement of my lifetime. President Donald Trump described Turner as one of the greats of all time. Media was not the only realm in which Turner left an enduring mark. As a philanthropist, he was passionate about environmental conservation. He established the Turner Foundation with a focus on safeguarding habitats, bettering communities, sustainable living, and environmental protection, and amassed around 2 million acres of land across North America, which his family continues to run, striving to rely on sustainable land management practices. But his pioneering development of television news was what earned him the title of Time's Man of the Year in 1991. CNN had become audiences' unblinking eyes on events including the first Gulf War and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Turner, Time noted, had not only broadcast world news but also influenced it by transforming viewers into instant witnesses of history. Turning the page. A familiar face to North Carolinians has a half-page photo spread in this article. It's Tom Tillis. Tom Tillis is obviously speaking to people with a lot of phones in his face. He says there's still time for Trump to change course before the midterms. Tom Tillis looks like he's in a wood-paneled elevator. It says number two on the side. He's dressed in a blue suit, pale, perhaps beige, shirt, pale gold tie. His eyes are wide open. His hair is cut short. Departing, this is the brief. Departing GOP Senator Tom Tillis takes aim at Trump's inner circle, by Brian Bennett. When Republican Tom Tillis packs up his Senate office in January to return to North Carolina, he will be taking with him a collection of elephant statues that greets visitors. There's one dressed as a circus clown, a pink elephant, a mama elephant snuggling with her baby. One of his favorites has its legs draped over the edge of a shelf, eyes rolled up, looking tired and relaxed. Tillis calls it laid-back elephant and sees himself spiritually in the same pose. Do I get intense? Of course. But I like being a little bit laid-back and a little bit real, Tillis tells Time in April, amid evidence that might fairly be described as mixed. In his remaining 8 months in office, Tillis makes clear he plans to continue showing Washington how a senator can wield power in the Trump era and get results. Already, he's held up President Trump's pick to be the next Federal Reserve chair, forcing the Department of Justice to drop an investigation into outgoing chair Jerome Powell. Tillis says he'll do the same for Trump's next attorney general nominee if that person downplays the storming of the Capitol January 6, 2021. In March, Trump fired Kristi Noem as Secretary of Homeland Security, days after Tillis had called for her resignation. Senator Tillis has shown the difference that one person with courage of his convictions can make in a key position, says longtime Republican strategist Whit Ayers. Some Trump allies have tried to paint Tillis as just another GOP traitor, a gadfly no more consequential than former MAGA star Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has excoriated Trump on everything from the Iran war to his mental fitness since abruptly announcing her resignation from Congress late last year. Tillis, however, has been more surgical in how he publicly defies the leader of his party, all in service of one goal, changing Trump's mind. It's a strategy that could make Tillis's final year among the most consequential of his two decades in politics, while also, he hopes, helping Republicans avoid a midterm shellacking. I did not come here to make friends, Tillis says, bending his tight smile slightly to the right. I came here to be a part of governing the most exceptional nation that's ever existed. Tillis's effort comes amid stiff political headwinds for his party. As Trump's approval ratings sink below 40%, in Tillis's view, if Republicans lose control of Congress, the administration's overreaching will be to blame. But Tillis himself will not have to face voters or worry about Trump's wrath. The president has called Tillis a loser and terrible, and celebrated when Tillis announced last year he was not running for re-election. But Tillis has avoided hitting back directly at Trump, instead keeping focused on the people advising the president as he angles for more changes in the administration's upper ranks. Some of Tillis's harshest critics are for Trump's deputy chief of staff, Stephen Miller, whom Tillis blames for policies that led to the brutal show of force by immigration agents in Minnesota, and whom Tillis was clearly referring to in a recent Senate floor speech when he said he was sick of stupid. Republicans would likely fare better in November if Miller left the White House, Tillis told Time. White House spokesman Stephen Chung tells Time Miller has worked relentlessly to advance Trump's agenda, and he will continue to do so. If there's a through line to Tillis's strategy, it is shoring up GOP support in toss-up states. I always laugh at people that are from states where a dead Republican can beat a live Democrat, trying to tell me what I gotta do to win an election in North Carolina. It is not too late, he argues, for his caucus to show some independence. Run alongside the president when it makes sense, and take exception on one or two things when it does not, he says. It does not mean you are any less loyal. It means you are smart and trying to get reelected. Among the elephants in his office is one he sees as key to his political rise. It appeared on the cover of Time in May 2009, a red, white, and blue Republican pachyderm labeled endangered species. Tillis, then a business executive and member of the state house, disagreed with the premise, but also saw an opening. Democrats had just won control of Congress in the White House. His instincts told him they would push their agenda too far. He quit his day job and launched into an effort to help Republicans ride the backlash to control of the North Carolina State House. In 2010, Republicans secured majorities in both the state Senate and House for the first time in 140 years. Now Tillis fears a mirror image of that is unfolding, as Trump's unpopular policies may tilt the state back toward Democrats. Tillis and Trump butted heads last year as Trump was whipping votes for his sweeping domestic policy package. White House officials insisted on cuts to Medicaid that were poised to drain billions from North Carolina hospitals and drive up state costs. Tillis told Trump he could not vote for the bill. Trump then put out a call for primary challengers against Tillis. The senator found himself boxed in. He knew running for re-election after voting against the GOP's biggest win would not work. But as Tillis sees it, now the party's in a pickle, trying to sell tax cuts while struggling to defend Medicaid cuts they approved with them. Tillis gets most agitated when talking about Trump's inner circle. He was particularly outraged at the Justice Department's decision to investigate Powell over whether he lied to Congress about renovations at the Fed's headquarters. The criminal probe came amid Trump's effort to pressure Powell to resign. After getting that investigation dropped, Tillis now hopes to further shape the DOJ. He points to the department's losing streak some of it tied to pursuing Trump's enemies. Of those prosecutions, Tillis says, we are going to regret this because we are setting a fairly low bar. He worries Democrats will someday follow Trump's example. It's political physics, he says. When he packs up his elephants in January, Tillis insists, his career in public office will be over. While he's ruled out a run for governor, he hopes to help state House Republicans hold on to the majorities he helped build. But I'd have to be blind not to know we're going to have head wounds, says Tillis. It's now a question, he says, of stanching the bleeding. The brief, health. Why it is so hard to reach your doctor and how to get a response, by Angela Haupt. Earlier this year, Olivia Mannion had one thing on her to-do list, schedule a six-month follow-up scan. She's been in remission from stage 4 Hodgkin lymphoma for nearly 4 years. And while MRIs are always nerve-wracking, booking one was supposed to be the easy part. What followed instead? 12 phone calls, 16 portal messages, a day off from work, and a call to her therapist. At one point, she sent a message through the patient portal, apologizing for being a pest. All I was trying to do was advocate for myself, says Mannion, 29, and I truly felt like I was being an inconvenience to the system. Join the club, Olivia Mannion. Not long ago, calling your doctor meant actually talking to your doctor. Someone answered the phone, and if you needed a call back, you usually got one that day. While that scenario has not entirely disappeared, it has become unrecognizable for many patients. They call and reach an automated system that cannot understand them, or they send messages that go unanswered for days. I just wanted you to hear my voice, Mannion wrote to her care team through the portal after weeks of messaging back and forth. I want you to hear me as a person. Mannion's experience is not unusual. What we are seeing is the culmination of a number of still ongoing changes in our healthcare delivery system, says Dr. Gary Price, president of the Physicians Foundation. It is very real, and it is getting worse. Yet patients are not helpless. Here is how experts and experienced patients recommend navigating the system. 1. Ask a crucial question at your first appointment. The single most useful thing you can do happens at your very first appointment with a new doctor. Ask how to reach them in an urgent situation. But choosing the right words is critical. Don't ask what the best way is to reach them, says Catherine Hicks, 50. Who has lived with chronic diseases since childhood. Ask what the most expedited way is. Some doctors, when asked this way, have given Hicks their cell phone number. Others have told her which staff member to ask for or which hours the portal is most reliably checked. 2. Leave a message that grabs their attention. A surprising amount of patient frustration is self-inflicted, says registered nurse Juliana Parker. Calling to say, hi, it's Mary, can you call me back, creates too much work for the office staff. Instead, provide your full name, date of birth, and callback number. Then state your symptoms, not your self-diagnosis. Those details determine how urgently your message gets escalated. 3. Use the portal strategically. The patient portal is best suited for questions that can wait 24 to 48 hours, says Dr. Titus Abraham, an internal medicine physician in Annapolis, Maryland. for anything you would describe as urgent, a phone call to the office is still the more reliable channel, because calls can be triaged in real time in a way that portal messages often cannot. 4. Be willing to work with the whole team. Some patients insist on speaking only to the physician when a nurse practitioner, physician assistant, PA, or triage nurse could answer the question just as well and far more quickly. The days of always expecting to talk to your physician for answers unfortunately do not exist as much anymore, says Stephanie Broussard, an oncology social worker. We are moving to an interdisciplinary approach, and that may mean the person giving you your answers is a PA or a triage nurse relaying guidance from the doctor. Five, do not stress about being a bother. Perhaps the most important thing, Broussard says, is to remind yourself you are not being a burden by calling. The triage lines, portal, and patient navigators exist because practices want to hear from you before symptoms become serious. You matter, she says, and it is important that you advocate for yourself and see that you are worthy of the time and attention. The View, Society, Double Danger, by Earl Smith and Angela J. Hattery. Smith is a senior research fellow at and Hattery co-founder of the University of Delaware Center for the Study and Prevention of Gender-Based Violence. Double danger. A judge had ordered Justin Fairfax, the former lieutenant governor of Virginia, to move out of the house where, on April 16, he killed his wife and then himself. April 19, in Shreveport, Louisiana, Shamar Elkins shot his wife, a second woman, and 8 children the day before he was due in divorce court. These are not anomalies. They are data points in a crisis that has persisted for generations. The two cases have catalyzed a necessary national conversation about the fact that a woman's risk of being killed by an intimate partner is highest in the weeks and months around a separation. But that conversation must not flatten the racial dimensions of this crisis. All 3 adult victims were black women. Both men were black. And while domestic violence crosses every racial and economic line, the data are unambiguous. Black women bear a disproportionate share of its consequences. According to a 2025 study by the Violence Policy Center, black women are killed by men at twice the rate of their white counterparts. Domestic violence homicide is a leading cause of homicide of women, accounting for 30% to 40% of femicides. The majority were killed with firearms. A separate Centers for Disease Control and Prevention analysis found more than 4 in 10 black women experience physical violence from an intimate partner during their lifetimes, a rate exceeding that for any other demographic. The problem is not simply a shortage of shelters or hotlines, though those are real. The deeper barrier is trust. For black women, a justified historical skepticism toward police and child protective services, institutions with long records of over-policing black families and under-protecting black victims, creates a painful calculus. Seeking help can mean inviting the state into one's home in ways that may bring new harms, including the removal of children or criminalization of a partner whose behavior has not yet risen to the level of a chargeable offense. We argue this is not paranoia, but rather a rational response to documented institutional patterns. At the same time, access to culturally competent mental health care for black men experiencing crisis, the other side of this equation, remains severely limited. Programs like the YB Men Project, which creates peer-supported spaces for young black men to address mental health openly, represent a promising model, but they're chronically underfunded relative to the scale of need. Elkins, the Shreveport man, sought help at a Louisiana VA hospital. Former Lieutenant Governor Fairfax's mental health deterioration was documented in court records, where a judge called very concerning his reluctance to seek care. In neither case did the systems intercept the trajectory toward violence. The response to these tragedies cannot be limited to candlelight vigils and expressions of heartbreak from elected officials, however sincere. Public policy must address the structural conditions behind the crisis. First, family courts must develop robust lethality assessment protocols triggered by the conditions most associated with intimate partner homicide, recent or pending separation, history of coercive control, access to firearms, deteriorating mental health in the respondent. These assessments exist, but they're not universally required or resourced. Second, federal and state funding for domestic violence services must be directed with equity in mind. Community-based organizations serving black survivors are routinely underfunded relative to their caseloads. The Federal Violence Against Women Act provides an important foundation, but its implementation must be evaluated for equity in resource distribution. Third, the mental health dimension of domestic violence cannot be treated as separate from prevention. Expanded access to affordable, culturally competent mental health services, particularly for black men in economic and legal crisis, is not a peripheral concern. It is central. This means funding community mental health infrastructure, not just crisis hotlines, and ensuring VA services reach veterans before, not after, a household is in acute danger. And finally, mandatory holding periods for firearm purchases during active divorce and domestic proceedings, combined with better enforcement of existing laws prohibiting individuals subject to domestic violence protective orders from possessing firearms, represent common sense interventions with documented effectiveness. Both Elkins and Fairfax had legal histories and behavioral red flags. Neither should have had a gun. We failed these families, and we cannot afford to fail anyone else. From the View Inbox, a D.C. brief by Philip Elliott, senior correspondent. Need proof the political map is turning against Republicans? Just spy the $79 million that the Senate GOP's super PAC set aside in April for Ohio, a state President Donald Trump carried all three times, and where Democrats last won a statewide election in 2018. The thinking around Washington was that John Husted, who was put in the seat after J.D. Vance left it to become Trump's right-hand man, would be a responsible custodian who could coast through this November's special election, to finish out the balance of Vance's term. But then, Democrats persuaded Sherrod Brown back onto the field. Brown, a progressive who can credibly slide into Trump's populist register, had been the rare Ohio Democrat who would win statewide, at least until an unexpected defeat in 2024 that was driven by the national mood more than anything. Husted may be a veteran of the campaign trail, but he's making the mistakes of a rookie, serving a string of comments ready-made for attack ads, like saying the solution to high prices is to earn more, and claiming Ohioans' work ethic is broken and that they're not very experienced at navigating the real world. That is not to say Brown is without baked-in dings. Before leaving the Senate, he'd been in politics dating back to his first campaign while he was still a student at Yale, way back in 1974. Still, despite the Brinks truck of cash backed up to the Husted campaign's loading dock, the nonpartisan Cook Political Report shifted the Ohio Senate race away from lean Republican status and into a true toss-up category. Climate is Everything by Simone Shaw, reporter. Deep ocean heat is moving closer to Antarctica, threatening the stability of the continent's ice sheets, a new decades-long study has revealed. The study in the journal Communications Earth and Environment confirms a warm mass known as circumpolar deep water has expanded and shifted toward the Antarctic continental shelf over the past 20 years. The ocean absorbs around 90% of the excess heat caused by global warming, most of it stored in the Southern Ocean. As the waters underneath the ice sheets warm, it risks destabilizing Antarctica's ice shelves, which play a key role in preventing inland ice sheets and glaciers from flowing into the ocean. The collective amount of fresh water in these inland glaciers could raise sea levels by about 58 meters, 190 feet, says Joshua Lanham, the study's lead author. In 2022, global average sea level reached a record high of 4 inches above 1993 levels, half of the 8 to 9 inches the level has risen since 1880. The rate is accelerating because of melting glaciers and ice sheets adding new volumes of water to our oceans. Besides increasing the risk of coastal flooding, rises in sea level also can contribute to more intense storms. Another study published in April found a system of global ocean currents known as the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, AMOC, is closer to collapse than previously thought, slowing down as air temperatures rise rapidly in the Arctic because of global warming. A collapse in this circulation would trigger a rise in Atlantic sea levels, shift the tropical rainfall belt that millions of people rely on to grow food, and expose parts of Europe to extreme cold winters and summer droughts. The AMOC circulation relies on the cold, dense water found in both the Arctic and Antarctic. These cold waters sink down into the ocean's depths, helping to power a so-called conveyor belt of deep currents that circle the globe. As both Antarctic and Arctic waters warm, that circulation's disrupted. Warm, fresh water from melted land ice does not sink as easily as cold, salty water. It is a very famous saying that what happens in the Southern Ocean does not stay in the Southern Ocean, says Ali Mashayek, a study author and professor of earth sciences at the University of Cambridge. There's a photo here. It's in grays and white and bright blue. It's It looks textured. Of course, it's not. It's two-dimensional. But the bright whites appear to be textured in a rounded way. And the bright light blue seems sharp, as if it's protruding from one of these textural branches. The caption reads, Antarctica's Shoesmith Glacier, seen March 7, is shrinking by 3 centimeters, 1.2 inches a day. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.